Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Susan Thompson of Colgate University, a host on New Books Network and African Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Thanks for tuning in. Today, my guest is Anais Angelo of the University of Vienna, where she is a postdoctoral researcher at the Institute for African Studies. She's written an exceptional book titled Power and the Presidency in Kenya, The Jomo Kenyatta Years, published in just 2020, just this year, by Cambridge University Press and its prestigious African Studies series. Angelo's book is part history, part political science that, for me, does two things. It analyzes the little studied institution of the office of the president by studying its first post-colonial office holder, Jomo Kenyatta. Beyond illuminating the office of the president and separating it from the man who holds the office, Angelo's book is also a study of why the politics of land distribution did not directly involve landless Kenyans. All told, Angelo's book is a study of post-colonial state building told through the process of negotiations that transformed Kenya into a presidential republic using extensive archival records. Angelo finds that neither the Brits nor the Kenyan elites of the day intended to create a political regime with near limitless executive power. The result, to my mind, is a political biography of Kenya's first president. It's a story of distant and discreet politicians such as Kenyatta that also narrates Kenya's colonial and post-colonial history. Anais, thanks for joining me today. I'm really excited to be able to learn from you.
So thank you so much for having invited me and for being interested in my work.
Yeah, it's a really lovely collection. I've become more interested in recent years in archival work because, of course, things are opening up and we're getting a better sense of how archival methods can be used to voice those who are not part of the archives. But before we get into any of that, I always like to start my interviews by asking about the researcher, the person, to frame them as an instrument of knowledge and the way, you know, the methods we choose, the methodology we deploy, the concepts we choose obviously are shaped by who we are. So I wonder if you could start our interview by saying a few words about yourself, not your childhood, of course, but your education. And what brought you to the study of Kenya and presidential politics more specifically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I am French. I was born in Paris. And actually, I think I became interested in African presidents from a fairly young age.
Oh, interesting.
Because my grandfather was a construction worker and happened to have worked for a few years in Mali. Mm-hmm. And he got interested in African politics, but, you know, in a very basic way. And one of the books he left behind him, because I've never got to meet my grandfather, mm-hmm. was a biography of Idi Amin Dada, written by a former minister of Idi Amin's government who had fled and went to exile. And I think in English it would be called the Idi Amin, the State of Blood. It has a cover with a lot of blood.
Yeah, I know that book. I know what you mean.
Yeah. And that's actually one of the first book I've read about anything related to African politics. And I got fascinated as a teenager in this book and in the topic of African presidents somehow. And as a French person, I also thought that looking back at it, there is a lot of debate about African presidents in France, mostly because we have this Trans-Afrique, so this Franco-African neo-colonial relations between French and African presidents. So mm-hmm. African presidents, it's very common to talk about African presidents in the news, and there are many films or documentaries and fiction that has been written about this. So somehow, I as I grew up, I could continue nurturing this interest in various ways. And so when I did my undergraduate at Sciences Po in Paris, I then went for 1 year at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And there I had a fantastic class with Professor Howard Steen on African economies. And we talked a lot about the World Bank's structural adjustment programs and how they were completely inefficient. And one of the questions I was always asking myself was, why did African presidents accept these programs? And the type of answers I could get was that they had no choice. But somehow I felt like I didn't know much about the agency of these African presidents, or I didn't know about the story told from their own perspective. And that's how I continued getting interested in this topic. I think it's really bordering very non-academic debates in France, and then academic debates, of course, in political science. Mm-hmm. And when I got the opportunity to do a PhD, it was clear that I wanted to do something on African presidents. But I changed the discipline. I left political science for history, to explore a little bit more, you know, where African presidents come from. And I thought that this is something that I could not do in political science, and something that I wanted to try to do in history. Of course, at the time, I didn't know exactly what I was going to work on. And somehow Kenya was also, it was a hazard. I wanted to compare Jomo Kenyatta and Leopold Sédar Senghor, the first president of Senegal. Uh-huh. But while I was doing my PhD, the Senegalese archive closed. And then I realized that actually I had enough material to do something on Kenyatta. So that's how I ended up writing only about Kenya and Kenyatta. And the book is, of course, based on my dissertation.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting take, because many of us take the office of the president for granted. So it's so interesting that you relate debates in your personal life, you know, just in French society, perhaps in your high school, about the role of the president and their lack of agency. So, of course, we'll get to agency. Your book is very strong on showing how Kenyatta behaved and why he behaved the way that he did. But speak a little bit before we move to that. Why did you find that political science wouldn't let you ask the questions you wanted to ask in the way that you wanted to try to answer them?
Well, it's also because I did my master in political science, and then I thought of doing a PhD also in political science. And at the time, I had a project on trying to understand and compare the trajectories of all African presidents since independence from a quantitative with quantitative and qualitative methods.
Right.
So I did some research on many the biographies of many African presidents, and I had picked a few case studies, and one of them was Kenya. And then I went to Kenya to do a field work. And when I was there, it was a real catastrophe. I was not doing anything, because I realized that I had very fixed concepts or categories of analysis, and that the complexity of Kenyan politics, but also the ambivalence of Kenyatta himself, was very difficult to translate into fixed categories. And it was for me very difficult to somehow settle on which categories would best explain Kenyatta's personal and political trajectories from his early years of political socialization up to Kenya's independence. But there is another aspect of this story, which is a more pragmatic one, which is that I also needed to find a scholarship to continue to do my PhD.
Of course.
And I do think it's important to mention. I found it very difficult to get scholarship for such a topic. And I thought that applying to a program in history would solve the two problems I had, one, the conceptual one, and the financial one. And that's how it worked. To a certain extent, I was also very lucky that the chair of Global and African Studies at the European University Institute, where I did my PhD, so my supervisor, Professor Doug Moses, got also interested in this strange topic, because at the time, there were really not so many people working on African presidents and their political biographies in an historical perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting answer, because, of course, the pragmatic part is as important as the intellectual part. And
exactly.
Yeah, I really like your honest answer. But I wanted to pivot a little bit. You clearly did some incredible archival work. You struggled with how to make sense of what you were finding there. Sometimes it wasn't enough to make a story, to write a story of Kenyatta, because he himself left such few traces of his thought and his actions. He was, you know, a secluded president, I guess. You call him distant and discreet in your work. Are there, mm-hmm. how do you approach the archives when you don't know exactly what you're looking for?
Yeah, I think my previous answer perhaps made it sound as if I thought that political science was too limited. But actually, I think that it is because I come from political science that I was able to do research on this topic in the way I did it. Because I think I somehow borrowed a theme from political science and tried to translate it into the history.
Yeah.
But when I started my research, I had never done any archival research. I had never been to an archive. And I didn't know how to deal with that. So my understanding of the archive was not only basic, but very naive, because I thought that if you don't find what you're looking for, somehow you're a bad researcher.
Right.
And so I looked literally everywhere. And I brought so many documents trying to locate Kenyatta somewhere. And it was helpful, because I realized two things. The first is that, well, there was not so much on Kenyatta himself, and that Kenyatta did not want to leave any trace as a president. So I think somehow I managed to overcome my fear of not finding anything. But the second thing is, because I looked at so many different types of files, and there were literally not so much, you know, that in the archives of the presidential office, even if there are files called presidential office, at least in the Kenyan National Archives, I found some interesting references to presidential powers in different types of archives, in the British National Archives, but also in the Kenyan archives. I found some references, at least, to Kenyatta, to some issues related to the president. So I realized that I was not looking for the right thing. I shouldn't look for Kenyatta himself. I should look for presidential powers.
Mm-hmm.
I was very lucky to find, very early on in my research, documents in the British National Archives about the political negotiations of the Constitution, the Independence Constitution, and that's when I realized that the making of presidential powers was not something obvious. Actually, nobody, either from the British administrators or among the Kenyan elite, had really thought about what it would be to have a president. And because nobody had thought about this, when the question was, okay, so Kenya is going to become a republic. What kind of republic is it going to be? Is it going to be a presidential one? Then, of course, the question was, who is going to be the president and how much power is he going to be given? And I found documents related to these issues. And some of these documents were also referring to conversations Kenyatta had had with British officials.
Right.
So this really helped me to refine the conceptualization of my project and early on go into the direction of the history of the presidential institution, of course, seen through, I mean, through the eyes of Kenyatta himself whenever it was possible. But when it was not possible, I tried to think, what are the other actors who somehow are telling us something about Kenyatta or the president or their relationship to the president?
It's such an interesting answer, because it's very clear that you have a political scientist perspective, but you also have like the tools of history. So it's an interdisciplinary study. I'm also trained as a political scientist. It didn't actually occur to me when I was reading your book that this was a history book. So of course it is, but in terms of its conceptualization and its tools, I thought it was, it's a great interdisciplinary study. That's all I'm trying to say. You have a very rich bibliography. So, of course, archives don't stand alone. They stand in conversation with, you know, the author, you, and they stand in conversation with different books. So which authors informed your thinking and writing most profoundly?
I think I would have two answers. Somebody who I really admired is Professor John Lonsdale, who has written a lot on Kenyan colonial history, but he has also written on Kenyatta and his early years of political activities when Kenyatta was in the 1930s writing as a journalist first and then joined a political party and somehow become more politicized. What I very much like is that, Lonsdale really took, always tried to think about, well, he has this concept of the importance of moral values and political imagination, and he's really connecting that to, I would say, perhaps indigenous concept, in this case, to Kikuyu thought.
Right.
And I think that's something I aspired to do, which was, of course, very difficult, but it somehow was a model of writing. And also, I think Professor Lonsdale is a very, I was lucky to meet him, and then he was eventually in the jury of my PhD defense, but he's also a very generous man. So he was always ready to have a conversation. He was very open and gave me a lot of advice. And I think reading his work and having the possibility to also talk to him was very formative. But I think that it's not just about the authors I've read.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about who I was able to talk to during the dissertation. During my research, I remember meeting once a political scientist, and I will remember his name, Tom. I have to think for a second. It will come back to my mind. Sorry?
No, go ahead.
I remember telling him that I could not. Tom Wolf.
Okay.
So he was working in for Institute of Polling in Kenya, but he's also a political scientist and has lived for a long time in Kenya. And I remember going to him and talking. I was then in Nairobi and telling him about my research and the fact that there were very few archives about Kenyatta himself, but that I had found one document that I thought was exceptional because it was a top secret document. So I was very excited because it was top secret. it was a document that was written by a prominent minister in Kenyatta's government, the Minister for Land, which is, of course, a very important ministry because land issues were central to Kenyan politics and Kenyan decolonization and, of course, the formation of the new state. Mm-hmm. Referring to some troubles that were happening in the district and the fact that the president had told him that he and another minister had to clean that up. There were not so many names, but it was already quite telling. It meant that these ministers had had a conversation with Kenyatta and that Kenyatta was aware of the political trouble going on and didn't want to intervene himself, but wanted to bring order back at any cost.
Right.
That's of course the point of having a top secret document. As I was talking to Tom Wolf, he told me, you know, just do research on this minister. So his name is Jackson Ngaine. Mm-hmm. And he even told me to change my whole PhD and just write on Ngaine, which was of course not possible as a third year PhD student.
Of course.
But this was a great piece of archives of advice because I realized that I had to do more than looking at the archives. I also had to do some field work.
Right.
And that's where trying to see what was the biggest story behind this document, in fact, led me to work on the Mau Mau, both on the Mau Mau after independence in Kenya. So the Mau Mau fighters, what happened to them after Kenya became independent. The resilient politicians from the opposition and how they were also they were silent. Mm-hmm. I think this is an important aspect of my research because it is about how, once the president is in power, how does he maintain power and keep everybody quiet, even though he is not himself, he does not himself intervene, or he doesn't always have the means to ensure order and stability on the whole territory. So that's why I wanted to mention that, because it's not just about books, but it's also about all these informal conversations I could have had. As I was a student, I was always very scared of these informal conversations, but somehow it really helped me and pushed me to do better research. So when I did this field work in a district called Meru, I was trying to understand how Kenyatta, about whom I knew so little, how he would pick his ministers, and in particular the Minister for Land.
Right.
How was he thinking? I was somehow trying to get into his head, but of course by different means. And it was fantastic. 2 weeks of field work, interviewing old politicians who are very willing to speak. Actually,
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I also had the opportunity to meet former Mau Mau freedom fighters, which was a completely different kind of interview. And it was very impressive. To meet these fighters who, of course, now are very old. Yeah. And not in a good health. So as a researcher, he was very formative, because I had been to the archives, that I had read many books, but what I could see was that some kind of history, parts of history had not necessarily, it's not that they were not known, but because they had not been written, they were not known to all, while there were so many people who are eager to know more about this history or to have their history known. So this was also a very formative experience in terms of why do we write? And I thought that I had read all these books and now I could understand why also these had, they had been written and what was the point of then writing something else.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow these reading and talking and doing field work are connected to each other. And yeah.
I think that's right, though, because you can read all the books and then you go and speak to someone. Maybe they're older, maybe they're frail in the way you describe. You know, the Mau Mau fighters must be in their late 80s and 90s by now.
Yeah.
But they have a memory, which, of course, is a human memory. It's impartial. It's perhaps self-selected and so on. But I think there is a lot to be said for putting the archives into conversation with people, you know, people you admire, Lonsdale or Wolf. I've also met Lonsdale and I found him just to be a true intellect. He's just curious about Kenya and he has that care of, you know, that ethic of care, I guess I could say, in his work. And that's what I'm hearing from you. You were so curious, but also so able to follow these things up. So that, I think that is definitely a strength of your work. Meru, of course, is an important district in Kenya. We can get into that in a few minutes. But the power of mentors and being open to suggestions is certainly something we can all benefit from, I think. And to that end, I mean, your book is, it's a very tight book, despite its depth and its robust analysis. It's just over 250 pages, if I remember correctly, 10 chapters. So you write in a very clean, very accessible way. And, you know, beyond being about Kenyatta, it is, as you noted already, a book about executive power. And it's a case study for Africa because it also talks about post-colonial land distribution. And as your book makes very clear, you know, Kenyatta's personality, his kind of, you know, distant, discreet, secluded, shaped the institution. And Kenyans, of course, live with some of his personality quirks today. I'm sure the way that executive power is formalized through practice. But of course, I think one thing that you do very well in the book is articulate and make clear for the reader and weave together three important, you know, contemporary facets of Kenyan politics, the legacy of the Mau Mau, as you just mentioned, the land distribution policies and practices, because it was really like, if you can buy it, then I'll sell it, which excluded a lot of Kenyans, as you write about. And then, of course, the ways in which the post-colonial state at the moment of post-coloniality, the state, you know, the executive branch in particular, co-opted political and economic resources, to my mind, creating a post-colonial patronage system. So that's how I understood your book. What would be the puzzle that frames your book in your own words? You know, there's always a disconnect between how the reader reads it and what the author intends.
You've been what I think is the main issue that I'm trying to answer.
Yeah. So in your, so you know how political scientists speak of puzzles, which of course is something we can talk about and critique, but how would you, because you, of course, one thing you had is you had this body of knowledge and you're gaining new information. You're talking to people, you're continuing to engage in archival work. How did the core of your book come together? That's really my question.
I think, as I said before, the idea of how the presidential powers became a political issue was a very central idea to my research. A very central question. But thinking back at this, I think that because I was new to history, I was somehow, I think, very anxious to to write history in the right way. And the way I wrote it was very much as if, probably as if I had written a novel, though I've never written one. But it was about trying to reconstruct, to tell a story. And this is the story of somebody who never really thought wanted to be in politics, never really shared his plans with anyone, suddenly finds himself in the position of becoming a prominent political actor, and knows that nobody wants him to be the leader. And by this time, and managed to become the most prominent actor. But it's also the story of someone who had an extraordinary political intelligence, and who, I think, knew politics better than anyone. And I think this is, of course, perhaps difficult to argue, but I think Kenyatta understood his enemies as much as well as his allies in politics in a very good way, and he could understand probably what they needed to be politically strong. So I think this is what I wanted to do. So of course the question was, you know, how did he get into power and how did he stay in power? But this idea of telling a story was very, very strong for me. And it was something that accompanied me throughout the research and the PhD years. Mm-hmm. Because also I was trained as a political scientist, I was still unsure, you know, how to do history, how to write history. And my supervisor once told me, you just put everything in a chronological order.
Oh, dear.
Of course, it's more complicated than that, but it helped me and really reinforced this sense of trying to tell a good story. And it's only at the end of my research that I realized that Kenyatta and the making of Kenyatta as the president happened at the same time as the making of presidential powers and the presidential constitution. Mm-hmm. And that was, for me, it is still something very important, because there was no idea of what a president or an African president should be. What we see today as something obvious as being the African president concentrating all powers,
yeah,
was not so obvious. And I also don't think that it was completely modeled out of the figure of the colonial administrator. I think there was so much hazard. And at the same time, it would also be limited to say that it's just hazard, because Kenyatta had a very good idea of, I mean, he was sure that he wanted to be in power.
Yeah.
And of course, we could also make it even more precise, because in the context of independence or decolonization struggle in Kenya, it was extremely difficult to settle on the figure of the father, what is called the father of the nation. Somehow they needed the myth to hold a divided country together. But at the same time, there is nothing true about this myth. I mean, of course, everybody now knows that. But what we don't know is, you know, if it's not the myth of the father of the nation, then what is it?
Right.
And so it became clear to me that it's the story of so many people who were not in favor of Kenyatta becoming president, but had no means and not enough power to oppose his leadership. And all of this really became clear when I was finishing my book. And it's really that the story was suddenly becoming clear to me in terms of the puzzle that I was trying to understand. So,
well, it's such an interesting. Go ahead.
No. I think now the question, somehow this is not a question that I had at the beginning of my research,
of
but
course.
The question would be, where do African presidents come from, and how can we explain, and what kind of documents, historical documents, do we have to retrace the political negotiations of presidential powers?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting puzzle that emerges through the arc of the book, and it raised questions for me. Like, are we talking about who is Jomo Kenyatta, or are we talking about what is Jomo Kenyatta? Because you write, of course, in the introduction about how his name was actually, he chose it. It became an African name. And his name became tied to Mau Mau. It became tied to power. So what would you answer? Is Jomo Kenyatta a who, or is he a what? Of course, he's a human being. But in the context of the presidency, he seems to be, what is Jomo Kenyatta? He's Kenya's first president. Okay, so what parts of his identity, his culture, his experience in prison, his negotiations with the British shape all of that? That's what I understood the book to be about. And it really got me thinking about my own work in other African countries. Like, how did Paul Kagame in Rwanda become the first president? Oh, he was the military commander. It's a very impartial answer. And I think what your book does so well is it gives us the tools to begin to think about the man, but also to think about the office. Mm-hmm. And that's my, I guess my, does, mm-hmm. is there anything in Jomo Kenyatta's this who, what dichotomy that shapes the presidency? Of course, his son, Uhuru, is the president today. Is there mm-hmm. anything your book can tell us about, maybe not political dynasty, but about the nature of presidential politics mm-hmm. in Kenya today?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I really like the distinction between who and what. I think the who question is something everybody wants to know. And it's also related to the illusion of biographies. We all want to know who is who.
Yeah.
But it's probably fair and somehow more complicated to understand what a president is, because it's about the how he's relating to other peoples. And I imagine that for Paul Kagame, probably something very similar. He appears as this military strong, but very smart mm-hmm. Leader. But at the same time, we have to understand what kind of authority does he have, and how he, as Kenyatta, how he uses his authority politically to create alliances or to force some people to do what he wants, or
exactly.
to force some people into a particular position, a political position. I think I actually what I now want to very much refrain from having to answer the who question because it's related to, because I have the impression that this is what we have tried to do for too long,
mm-hmm.
Trying to understand their characters, and we don't we will probably never know. But at the same time, I think the type of sources that historians or political scientists have access to also shape these two questions.
Sure.
I was able to do some research on Leopold Sédar Senghor, And it's incredible to see the type of archive that there is, because Stengel was writing every day about politics to the French ambassador, the French commissioner, something that Kenyatta would never done. And of course, this gives a completely different image of what kind of president he was. But I think, and when it comes to who is Jomo Kenyatta, and perhaps how can this help us to better understand Kenyan politics today, and in particular the politics of his son, Uhuru? I think I would say that Kenyatta was a man who has always been surrounded by enemies, and that probably shaped his personality, or his political personality, if I can.
Of course, of course.
And I think it's the same and this setting shaped also the presidency, because it is about holding together divisions, very fragile administration. And I think somehow his son inherited the system and is in the exact same position as his father. So he has to make alliances with his political enemies to make his government work. So he has worked with different various figures, either in the opposition, but also prominent politicians who also today are aspired to be his successor. So I think this is the similarity that I see between the father and the son. And probably it's more a question of political systems than a question of dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I somehow it is also difficult not to get to get away so quickly with the concept of dynasty. I think something that I have not worked on and could perhaps answer that question, but is probably very difficult to work on, is the role of Jomo Kenyatta's wife and Uhuru's mother, Mama Ngina. It's the connection between the two, and it would also probably, it could perhaps answer the who question.
Yeah, I think that's a good hunch.
I haven't done any research on that, so I can't say much.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
It's an interesting hunch, though. You're probably right, because there's also something in like the family dynamic that we will just never know. And I asked the question, I should be more frank about my question. I'm a Canadian, so Justin Trudeau is our prime minister right now. He comes from Pierre Elliott Trudeau, one of Canada's most dynamic prime ministers, and Canadians frame him as a product of a dynasty. No, he's a product of a state system and a political party system that made him. But of course, his mother, Pierre's wife, is a central figure. I think that's a really interesting hunch. Canada has moved to speaking about Margaret Trudeau, but not in a political science or historical way.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to pivot back to the Mau Mau uprising. So you have, there's a symbolic power for Kenyatta as part of the Mau Mau or not part of the Mau Mau. This is like a tension in the book. He didn't actually participate, if I understood correctly, but he was able to use the uprising as a way to solidify his power. So in your mind, what is the role in Kenyatta's political thought or perhaps his political imagination of the Mau Mau?
This is, I think, a difficult question. I think Kenyatta did not engage so much with questions of political ideologies. He had some values, moral values, to use Lonsdale's words, that were profoundly Kikuyu, but at the same time, of course, it is impossible, I think, to say what Kikuyu moral value is, because it has been renegotiated over and over over time. But I don't think that Kenyatta has very strong ideas, or at least I didn't see it this way, about political ideology. So his point is not should the government distribute the land. I think I can say that he he's completely above these issues, and he thinks, how can I stay in power? Even if this is, of course, the shortcut, but he's such in a fragile political position that he's more concerned with holding everything together. And he knows that he can do that because he's seen both as a Mau Mau and not as a Mau Mau. And he knows that he's the only politician to be seen this way. And it's an asset because Kenya, I think Daniel Branch wrote that Kenya is not just a post-colonial country, it's a post-Mau Mau war country. It's a country that has been traumatized by the Mau Mau war, but it's also an elite that has been completely reshaped in the wake of the Mau Mau war. So the elite itself has been created or emerged out of the Mau Mau war. Well, perhaps now I also think that now that I hear myself, I think John Monte would disagree with me and say, no, Kenyatta also had a particular perception of the Mau Mau as an anti-constitutional movement. It's true that he was a man who had been very much impressed by the ceremonial aspects of politics when he was in colonial Britain. And he's not a man of a violent rebellion.
Right.
So he's someone who wants to be on the side of the constitutionalist and the moderate. But I don't know still to which extent we can really talk about a political ideology and how much Kenyatta positioned himself on the questions of the Mau Mau war. Although I should mention one more thing, which is that Kenyatta was very much convinced that you have to work for that work is absolutely necessary to achieve anything in life. Mm-hmm. You can't get anything for free. This is something that he would repeat over and over again in his speeches. So he was de facto against this idea of giving something for free to a poor person. But again, I don't know if this is a question of political ideologies or Kikuyu moral values.
Or sheer pragmatism.
Yeah, and pure pragmatism. Yeah. But I think he's also very old when he comes to power. He's 70 years old. So probably his political imagination is less about nationalist parties and more about early political parties during when Kenya was still a British colony. But he's never been somebody who was the maker of a big nationalist party with a vision for the nation as
right,
a whole.
Right. And he seemed, and correct me if I'm wrong, he seemed ambivalent about redistribution of land. And if I understood your analysis, if there's a willing buyer and a willing seller, then there's a transaction to be made that, of course, favored elites, politicians, and business persons. It disenfranchised Kenyans who were already disenfranchised. What is the role of land in his thinking, if any? He didn't see it as a resource to be bestowed, that's for sure.
What is the role of the...
Of land.
I didn't hear
the role land. Of land. Yes, of course, land, yeah, as you I know, think, is so important in the study of African politics. Mm-hmm. But what was land as a commodity for Kenyatta?
I think, as I said, I think land is, of course, a very important element in his Kikuyu moral values. So having land is having authority, manhood, and somehow seniority. But Kenyatta understands, I think, very well that land is a political resource, that he can distribute land to, because land has also so much moral value and moral power,
right?
That he can use that to tame his enemies. But at the same time, he was not aware of the technocratic and administrative intricacies of land redistribution and the land negotiations with the British. And to a certain extent, so he did not seem to care so much. So I would say that he's aware that authority comes from land owning, and that land can be a political resource, but for the bureaucratic aspect of land redistribution, he really stayed aloof from this debate and complication.
So I guess that's why you introduced the idea or the concept, I guess, of disempowered regionalism. He distanced himself from the issue of land, definitely from the landless masses, surrounding himself with his, you know, keeping his friends close, but his enemies even closer. To that end, is it that Kenyatta as president in the role of the executive created a highly centralized patronage-based state? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, but at the same time, I wouldn't say that Kenyatta is the only architect.
Good.
because the rest of the elite realized that they were either out of the state and they would not have access to state resources if they would oppose a centralized state system, or they are in and have access to state resources and actively participate to construct a centralized system that post-colonial Kenya as an extremely centralized state emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Kenyatta was not only so powerful, but also so visionary, because he understood that the other political actors did not have either the resources, but also the financial land or even legal resources to oppose this kind of central strong state.
Mm-hmm.
And that to exist and survive politically, they had to be part of this state model somehow. And they understood that very well. And I think that's why it came that's why it emerged. I was always impressed by the way the constitution in 1963 or 64
mm-hmm.
was phrased, that when it comes to presidential powers, it is said that the president, it was said that the president has the power to nominate the members of his government and do any other thing.
Yeah.
And of course, some politicians thought to oppose that, but they were too weak for an alternative state system to come into force.
Of course,
and it is not that Kenyatta concentrated all the powers yet. It is simply that the presidential powers were vague and not clearly thought of, and still undefined, and nobody really knew what it would mean at the time. And then it would be slowly, slowly defined.
It's such a fascinating answer. Of course, I'm sitting in the United States. The Trump presidency has completely reconfigured mm-hmm. the norms of the presidency here in the United States. And I say that as an outsider. I'm just looking at it as a political scientist. Your book gives us a lot of insight to how presidential power works, regardless of the system, because states have their own actors and their own dynamics. and different things happen, but there's always some, you know, causal paths, I guess, some causal lines that political scientists can follow. So if you're studying Trump, you should probably read a nice Angelos book. I want to begin to pivot because I've kept you for over an hour. I'm really fascinated in all of my interviews about the cover. The image that you chose. So you have a British official, looks like a military official in his white outfit, and then Kenyatta next to him in clearly perhaps a Kikuyu beaded cap holding the Constitution of Kenya. Is there a story behind your cover, your choice of cover art, cover image, I guess, in this case?
Yes, so my choice was somehow limited because I was asked by Cambridge University Press to pick a picture that they would have the copyright for. Mm-hmm. But I picked this one because Kenyatta is seen as, he's celebrating independence. He's holding this constitution, which I'm not so sure he has read, actually. I don't know. I say that to make a joke, but during the independence negotiations, he was always silent. He didn't like this kind of very long meeting, and he didn't like to say what he was to reveal his mind. Mm-hmm. He didn't like bureaucratic words. So and he had other people do the tricky, complicated political and legal stuff for him. So Prince Philip is bowing his head.
Oh, that's Prince Philip.
Yeah. And Kenyatta is holding the Constitution. He has his very famous Luo hat, mm-hmm, on his head and his fly whisk. And Kenyatta was said to be an amazing orator. He would speak very, very well, especially in Kikuyu and Swahili. The British would get mad because he would use a lot of the figurative expressions and that they could not translate properly. So he was not sure he would say that Kenya will take Britain by the tail and shook it, or if it's just talking about a different, any lion. So there would be a lot of discussion about what Kenyatta was actually saying. So what I see with this image is a very a powerful man, that man on stage, and he's alone as well. And this was something that I was not sure. I thought maybe I would take a picture of him and the independent government, but I somehow wanted to emphasize the idea of Kenyatta being an isolated player.
Yeah,
And he's also has his eyes half closed, so he's as he once said, he has something cooking, I think, on this picture. And that's why I picked this this picture. And I really wanted also to emphasize the idea of the political negotiations of powers, which I think is it's an important aspect of my book, and not just the man.
Exam.
I wanted to see Kenyatta in action.
I mean, it's a stunning image. And of course, you point out the whisk. I didn't even notice the whisk at first glance. That becomes an important political symbol. Daniel Arap Moy, of course, carries a whisk everywhere that he goes. Mm-hmm. It's a really multifaceted and, just a gorgeous cover, a gorgeous piece of analysis. Thank you for your work. Just to finish here, my very last question for you, what are you working on now? What can we look forward to from you?
So now I have a project on Kenyan women who were politically active in the 60s and 70s in informal politics. So especially women who campaigned to become a parliamentarian, mm-hmm, right after independence. This was something that was certainly missing in my book, that I have not talked about women at all. And I thought it I have to interrogate that. So now I've shifted and try to do, I work on a different type of invisible actors. This time it's not the president, it's women, but it's also about the question of, are women really, are they really invisible in formal politics right after independence? Or is there anyone who wants to make us believe that there were no women in high or elite politics at the time?
That's a great second project from a wonderful first book. I've been interviewing Anais Angelo on her book, Power in the Presidency in Kenya. Thanks for joining us.